Hello, everyone, and welcome to the National Geographic Society program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'll be reading articles published in August of 2025 by the Geographic Society today, so I hope you enjoy the program. We'll begin with this article from the History and Culture section, Who Were the Original Showgirls? Taylor Swift is just the latest artist to be enchanted by the iconic entertainers, with their glittering costumes and racy moves. It's by Aaron Blakemore. When Taylor Swift announced her 12th album was entitled The Life of a Showgirl, speculation raged as to its contents. Is Swift in her extravagantly feathered, bare-chested era? Though the singer's announcement elicited images of sequins, plumes, and not much else, it also put the spotlight on the trope of the showgirl, a Vegas beauty now vanished from modern performances. Who was the showgirl, anyway? And why is the idea of her so persistent? Like Swift herself, showgirls are revered for beauty, bling, and the ability to bear it all to their fans. Here's a brief history of the iconic performers. The showgirl's European roots. Women have long been formidable entertainers, but the original term showgirl emerged around 1750 and was first used pejoratively to describe a woman who dressed or behaved showily. The girls are mere showgirls like a myriad of others, sing, play, dance, dress, flirt, and all that, complains a character in Maria Edgeworth's 1841 Patronage, one of the earliest uses of the term. Meanwhile, social changes in the 18th and 19th century birthed the predecessor of the revue show and of showgirls. In England, pubs began expanding into music halls in response to a growing demand for quick-moving shows featuring exciting entertainers. In France, cafes and cabarets became popular venues, along with the chanteuses who performed there. In 1881, French artist Rudolf Salis took the cabaret one step further when he opened La Chatte Noire, or The Black Cat, a cabaret he envisioned as a haven for his fellow artists. At first, the venue operated like an artistic salon, but soon Salas realized he had a potential moneymaker on his hands. Over time, the café became one of Paris's most popular, and its variety programming sparked imitators like Joseph Euler and Charles Zilder, who opened their own venue in 1889. They named it after a red windmill, and the Moulin Rouge was born. Can-can dancers and the birth of burlesque. Inside, daring female dancers lifted their skirts to perform the newest dance, the can-can, showing their petticoats and more intimate undergarments as they kicked their legs in the air. The club's racy demi-monde of dancers and patrons was a favorite subject for Parisian artists, most notably Henri de Toulouse-Lautrec. The shows also included satirical skits that burlesqued the political and social figures of the day. Other venues quickly followed suit as music halls and cabarets became havens for both poorer city dwellers who could not afford the theater or opera and wealthy people eager to slum it in the artsy Montmartre. One of the most famous was the Folies Bergère, which had gotten off to an uninspiring start as a theatrical venue in the 1860s. In 1886, impresario Edouard Marchand took over as manager, introducing a new show and a new kind of female performer. Taking inspiration from his own love of women and the popularity of dancers and chanteuses, Marchand decided to center the revue on the female form, with nearly nude women a scandalous part of the show. The idea soon hopped the Atlantic, and by the 20th century, the word showgirl was part of the American vernacular. Theaters touted well-dressed women, entertainers in advertisements and show titles, promising a celebrated chorus of stunning showgirls gorgeously gowned, according to one 1902 ad. It would take an American impresario and the advice of a shrewd woman to birth the glamorous showgirl we know today. Florenz Ziegfeld had gained acclaim first by showcasing bodybuilder Eugene Sandow, then by bringing Anna Held, a Polish-French singer and Ziegfeld's mistress, to the U.S., tempting audiences with photos of the nude singer bathing in milk. She suggested he use the formula so popular at the Folies Bergère, writes historian Eve Golden. Part girly show, part fashion show, and with some comedy thrown in. He tried it out and won big. The Ziegfeld Follies was born, and it would run for over 30 years. Ziegfeld's Follies girls were beautiful, but they were known for more than their looks. Fashion and glamour were a critical part of the revue show. As historian Elspeth H. Brown notes, some of the women in such reviews were actually tasked with being fashion models instead of dancers or actresses, putting the show in showgirl as they paraded clothing before the audience. Ziegfeld's shows would give hundreds their start in showbiz. Though some became celebrities, other showgirls were stigmatized for putting their bodies on display. Long-standing connections between the theater, prostitution, and sexual exploitation plagued showgirl reviews, and sexual abuse was rife within the profession. Wealthy patrons expected to be able to court and exploit dancers who caught their attention, and the musical revue genre coexisted with burlesque shows, strip teases, and other titillating forms of entertainment. Showgirls Go Vegas. That connection remained as showgirls made their way to Sin City in the 1940s and 50s, chasing the wealth and glamour of a rapidly growing Las Vegas strip. The first modern casino there, El Rancho Vegas, featured the El Rancho Starlets, a group of showgirls renowned for being scantily clad. As Vegas grew and celebrity investment yielded an entire strip of casinos, nightclubs, and performance venues, showgirls grew more popular, sometimes even eclipsing the big-name performers on the bill. Casinos became notable for choosing only the most beautiful women to process in feathers and sequins, dazzling showgoers and helping give Las Vegas its reputation for entertainment. Indeed, showgirls are credited with helping the city weather a rough recession. Though the genre declined during the 70s and 80s, eventually, though, long-standing shows like the Tropicana's Folies Bergère began shutting down, and the opulent showgirl revue is now a thing of the past. But the showgirl's legacy remains. The performers have a long love affair with filmmakers who have featured their lives in movies like 1995's Showgirls and 2024's The Last Showgirl. Still famed for their over-the-top style, glamorous moves, and bare bodies, their legacy still lives in live theater today. Just don't use the word as shorthand for something seedy. None of us like being called chorus girls, Tropicana showgirl Felicia Atkins told a reporter in 1959. It implies a girl with no class. We want to be known as showgirls. Perhaps Swift will transform the term again, one track at a time. That completes the article. The title, was Who Were the Original Showgirls? By Aaron Blakemore. This next article is titled, Buddhist Monks Have a Secret to Reducing Suffering, Even When You're in Pain. Most of the global population suffers from chronic pain. Here's what we can learn from Buddhism about how to manage it. It's by Aaron Blakemore. Is it possible to feel physical pain without suffering? For thousands of years, that question has fueled Buddhist mindfulness practices that combat pain relief by embracing the inevitability of suffering. Today, an estimated 10% of the global population suffers from chronic pain, and the U.S. spends more on combating chronic pain than diabetes and cancer combined. Actor Chris Hemsworth is no stranger to physical suffering, as he struggled with chronic back pain for much of his life. In episode 3 of Limitless, Live Better Now, streaming on Disney Plus and Hulu starting August 15th and on National Geographic starting August 25th, the 41-year-old travels to South Korea, where people treat pain with both ancient wisdom and modern science. There he searches for tools to help him live with chronic pain and transcend it. Befriending pain. Discerning pain from suffering is at the heart of Buddhism, says palliative care physician and pain expert B.J. Miller, who's featured in the show. It's a time-tested way to unburden yourself and live with what you can't control. Buddhism, a belief system followed by approximately 4.1% of the world's population and about 17% of South Korean adults, teaches that suffering and desire are part of the human condition. That might seem like bad news for people experiencing the physical and emotional turmoil of pain, but Buddhism emphasizes a path out. To attain liberation from pain, practitioners must learn not only to accept it, but to also realize its impermanence. This is something deeply familiar to Jing Yeo, a Buddhist monk of 50 years, who rose to become Grand Patriarch of the Byeom-myoso Temple in South Korea in 2023. He uses a mix of storytelling, science, and psychology in his teachings. In Buddhism, we do not try to avoid or remove suffering, he explains. Instead, we try to see suffering as it truly is. All branches of Buddhism involve examining suffering. The Buddha himself is quoted as saying that suffering and its end were all he taught. But Buddhist approach to suffering varies. Sion Buddhism, a branch of the religion followed in Korea, is similar to Zen and involves meditation, bowing, contemplation, study, and other practices. In Korean Buddhism, the solution to suffering is not simply healing or peace, but to delve into the core of existence, says Yeo. By diving into suffering instead of trying to fend it off, he says, one can begin to realize that pain is a thought just like any other. The fundamental mind does not know pain or suffering, he explains. Instead, a human's attachment to their own thoughts generates the concept of pain and suffering. Yeo learned this the hard way when he once suffered a head injury while laboring at a temple. Reeling from a long fall and a bleeding head, he managed to move his focus from the aching pain to his mind. Beneath the pain, he says, he found a part of himself that was unworried about his suffering. When I reflected on my mind, I observed that it did not waver from the injury, and it was serene and peaceful, he recalls. I realized that no matter the circumstances, the mind is always peaceful and unmoving, clear and quiet. This is the difference between pain and suffering. Not only are Buddhist practices associated with pain relief for some followers, but they are even considered powerful enough to help some come to terms with disability and death. That doesn't surprise Miller, who took Hemsworth to the Biomioso Temple to immerse him in sometimes painful activities, like prostration meditation, which involves folding the body into a reverent bow over 100 times in one session. Miller compares pain to an unwelcome house guest. If he won't leave, then you might as well invite him in to have a seat and figure out some way to get along. The science of Buddhism. The perceived ability of Buddhist practitioners to rise above pain has long intrigued scientists, especially as the religion's tenets have spread in the West. There's much to be said for going into the feeling of pain, says Miller, and no doubt it has things to teach us. So do other less painful forms of mindfulness, and research suggests it might not take long to see results. In one 2014 study, researchers used meditation as an intervention for people with migraine pain. Participants took a 20-minute guided meditation class based on the Buddhist concept of loving kindness, which involves cultivating compassion toward the self and others. Afterwards, these migraine sufferers reported 33% less pain and 43% less tension, leading researchers to conclude that meditation may be an effective, quick, and portable means of reducing pain and emotional tension. There are plenty of theories regarding the physical benefits of mindfulness. Potential advantages include a stronger immune system, better sleep, even a reduction in suicidal or other intrusive thoughts. Despite researchers trying to understand the science of meditation and other Buddhist practices for decades, their findings vary wildly. Some studies suggest that advanced meditation techniques that de-emphasize a person's inner narrative are more effective for pain relief than those focusing on a single thought or object. Others have found physical differences in long-time practitioners. A 2024 review of 21 brain studies found that meditation causes structural and functional changes in large-scale brain networks. Another study asked 13 Zen meditators and 13 non-meditators to undergo fMRI scans while experiencing moderate pain. Compared to their counterparts, the meditators' brains showed less activity in brain regions linked to emotion. Those who didn't meditate showed more activation in brain regions associated with pain, leading researchers to conclude that meditation may help decrease sensitivity to pain. How embracing pain can help you get through it. Befriending the mind and even the pain might solve suffering, but that doesn't mean the pain itself isn't real. Instead, Buddhist practices like meditation can help turn down the volume on pain signals or even distract an individual from painful experiences for a bit. Getting started is as simple as taking a breath, Yeo says. Try to feel your breathing in short moments during your commute to work, or simply observe yourself when you feel stressed or angry and accept the emotions as they are. He emphasizes that these practices are accessible to everyone. The teachings of Buddhism are not limited to specific cultures, he says, advising others to practice speaking gently to themselves. Do not avoid suffering. Observe it with indifference and wrap it with compassion. Try to end the day telling yourself, "Today was hard. Are you okay? You did a great job." Simply telling oneself, "This is Buddhist practice in compassion." After all, says Miller, pain is just one aspect of existence. There's so much besides pain that is worthy of your attention. And that completes the article. The title was Buddhist Monks Have a Secret to reduce suffering even when you're in pain, by Aaron Blakemore. This article's title is This Summer Has Seen the Shortest Days in Earth's Recorded History. Scientists break down the reasons why days are getting shorter and the mystery they're still trying to solve about Earth's core, by Brian Handwerk. Across the Northern Hemisphere, people are soaking up the long hours of summer sunlight, with no idea that they're experiencing some of the shortest days since modern timekeeping began, by a millisecond or so. July 9th was the shortest day of the year, because Earth spun faster, 1.34 milliseconds quicker than the standard 24-hour rotation, according to the International Earth Rotation and Reference Systems Service, or the IERS, and U.S. Naval Observatory. This summer, it's predicted we'll see two more historically short days, July 22nd and August 5th. Fluctuations in Earth's spin rate aren't uncommon, but scientists are mulling the reason behind a recent surge in faster rotations. Over the past decade, the average length of day has mostly been shrinking. This has been especially notable over the past 5 years or so, sometimes clocking in at less than 24 hours, says Nicholas Stamatakos, an astronomer at the U.S. Naval Observatory's Earth Orientation Department. Here's the science behind why Earth is spinning faster as it orbits the sun, if scientists think it will last, and why even the odd millisecond might impact critical technologies. Why is Earth spinning faster? Variations of Earth's rotation are due to a complicated mix of factors, but scientists say a few stand out. The Moon affects Earth differently during its orbit. When it's positioned close to the equator twice a month, gravitational pull slows Earth's spin a bit. But the Moon also moves nearer the poles twice a month, and at those times the Moon's gravity helps Earth spin a bit faster. Our planet and atmosphere rotate in sync, sharing a momentum that can't be changed by only one of the two. Our atmosphere spins more slowly during the summer due to variations in the jet stream. This means the planet must speed up to compensate and maintain the system's angular momentum at a constant level. Inside the planet, something weird is also happening that physicists can't totally explain. For some reason, Earth's core has been slowing down for the last 50 years, and to maintain angular momentum, the solid Earth above has been spinning a bit faster to compensate. We don't know why or what the core might do in the future, says Duncan Agnew, a geophysicist at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. Are these the shortest days in history? The past few years have seen the shortest days since atomic timekeeping began in 1955. But they aren't even close to the shortest days in Earth's history. On average, Earth's days have been growing longer for several billion years. Since the Moon was formed, its gravity and influence on ocean tides incrementally slows Earth's rate of rotation. Analysis of mollusk shells from the dinosaurs' sunset era reveals that 70 million years ago, the year's 372 days were only 23.5 hours long. Fossilized corals from 430 million years ago suggest that far more recent or more frequent sunrises and sunsets once framed a 21-hour day. Even as the long-term trend lengthens days, short-term fluctuations have produced plenty of short day periods. The days were all shorter than the upcoming ones in the 1820s, and from about 1865 to about 1880, says Agnew. According to the IERS, there were actually shorter days in June and August of 2022 and June of 2024. Will you be able to notice sped-up days? Days of long daylight are obvious, like those around the summer solstice. So are the long cold nights before and after December 21st. But if Earth's 24-hour cycle was shortened by the blink of an eye, you likely wouldn't notice. A blink takes 100 to 400 milliseconds, while the difference in day lengths is only about 1 millisecond. A single isolated shorter day is important only for astronomers and other specialists, says Judah Levine, a physicist and fellow at the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Astronomers need extremely accurate timekeeping to understand the positions and movements of celestial objects and events. Tiny discrepancies can create big errors. When time lost to shortened days begins to add up, timekeepers add an extra second to the running clock, bringing astronomical time back in sync with the atomic time it had lagged behind. This is called a leap second, and it's been implemented about every year and a half since 1972. Most people didn't notice that either. And with that, I'm afraid we have run out of time. You've been listening to the National Geographic Society program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader today. I hope you enjoyed the program. The articles were all published in August of 2025 by the Geographic Society. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with its premium programming offered on a 24/7 basis. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.